Welcome home. We are WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're positively coming at you with the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I'll have some Pac-Man scratch-offs to give away all month long. Roz is threatening to give me more batches of these because I'm going to need it. We're going everywhere this month. I'm wearing my Costas shirt. That's going to be later this month. And with the Orioles playing like 1 o'clock games, 4 o'clock games, Toronto, we're going to be out on the road. All of it brought to you by our friends at Jiffy Lube Multi-Care as well as Liberty Pure Solutions, keeping my water fresh. We're going to be at Fadley's on Friday and the Tampa Razor in town. We're going to be at Cooper's North and Timonium next Tuesday promoting Fleet Week. We're going to go back to Cooper's down in Fells Point on the 14th. We're going to be at State Fair in Catonsville before the Toronto game on June 6th. It's a Thursday. We're going to be at Coco's in Lauraville on the 12th. Costas aforementioned in Dundalk before the Orioles Yankees game, and Orioles Yankees sort of means something, and Pappas in Parkville on the 25th of June. So we're out and about, lots of lottery tickets to give away, lots of crab cakes to eat. I'm probably going to get some crabs. I'm wearing my Costas shirt right now because I'm rubbing it in. Pete Williams has been my friend for 30 years. We are friends on the field, off the field, in the real world, in Tampa. We have been known to have drinks together on, when I'm in for hockey games, Springsteen concerts, things that take me to Tampa, spring training, maybe if they invite me sometime soon. And I was down looking for you a couple weeks ago with this optimistic Oriole 100 and win team. And I think the last three times you and I have gotten together to eat Cuban food somewhere in Tampa, we don't even talk about baseball anymore, even though you were like the USA Baseball Weekly insider writer dude. You've written books on collectibles and sold books and like all that. We don't talk baseball anymore because my team stunk. And now my team's good. And I'm like, hey, we're playing Tampa. Maybe I should call Pete. Pete, do you still watch baseball?
Yeah, I do. And I think the what happened last year with the rules changes helped a lot with the pitch clock and some of the other rule changes. I think they still have a big nut to crack with this whole pitching quandary where we're only going to let pitchers pitch four innings and they're still going to blow out their arms and that sort of thing. So that, I think, is a major problem for baseball to address. But yeah, I got back to it a little bit. And part of it's because of this Tampa Bay Rays team. Now, they have made the playoffs five straight years with a limited payroll. And, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, the Rays are largely responsible for ruining baseball in many respects, right? They came up with this shift. They came up with the idea that we're going to just obsess over analytics. We're going to trot out a different lineup every night. We're going to blow out so many arms. We're going to just turn over our roster constantly. But it does work. And so I guess all those Ivy Leaguers and MIT types in the front office for the Rays, the formula does work. It's not a traditional one, but it's one that's pretty entertaining. You combine that with $10 tickets, a lot of good promotions. And yeah, I'm one of these people, I may be in the vast minority, but I kind of like Tropicana Field for a number of reasons. And so you put all that together, I think at least from a Rays perspective, it's been a refreshing last few years here in the Tampa Bay area.
I don't hate Tropicana Field. And I, you know, I had Luke in the passenger seat when I was searching you out six, 7 weeks ago. We're down there for spring training and we drive by and Luke laughs at it because it looks sideways. It looks kind of tilted on the side of the road. And it's a joke for 30 years. And the team was so bad. And then the team got good. Pete, I don't even know your whole background. And people can Google you. You're down in the Tampa area. You do a lot in the fitness space. You've written books on collectibles, but I know you as a kid coming up. We're kind of the same age. We're both young. And you were in and out of Baltimore a lot because of Cal Ripken. And there was no team in Washington. And I don't even know what your original love of baseball is about. I don't think of you as a Tampa guy. You certainly didn't grow up with a Tampa Rays hat as a little boy or whatever. But all these years later, you're raising a family in Tampa. You've made Tampa your home. And it's a weird baseball market, right? Because you can play baseball 13 months a year there. They always thought there was going to be Hispanic this and Cuban that and Anglo this. And it's and unlike here where they play lacrosse, it's like baseball, 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 and Strawberry and Gooden and all Wade Boggs. All of that went on in Tampa. And yet it's a place they can't sell baseball. And even guys like you that love baseball, they don't like the dome. They don't drive across the bridge. What's a team not good enough for you? I mean, the team's been frigging great for 15 years, right? Like, it's Tampa's weird for baseball, and you moved into it as a journalist, really, a baseball journalist.
Yeah, I'm from Virginia. I lived in Richmond until I was 11. Those were my formative years with the AAA Richmond Braves, Dale Murphy, Brett Butler, those guys, and then moved to Northern Virginia. I actually became a baseball writer out of college for USA Today, having only seen four major league games in my life in person. Now, that may sound ridiculous, but Nestor, you know, as someone of our generation, you could follow the game through the newspaper every day. You could follow it through the Game of the Week or WTBS. That was more than enough. And so when baseball expanded to Arizona and Tampa Bay in 1998, I went to my editors at USA Today and I said, look, you know, I'm on the plane all the time. We didn't have a team in DC and would not have one until 2005. Why don't you let me move to Arizona or to Tampa and I could be based there. We'll save money on spring training. And they let me do it. And so they sent me to Tampa. I was there for a year. They said, we'd like you to move back. I said, I'd like to stay. And so back when I went freelance and branched out into all manner of sports coverage, TV, radio, all sports, then some fitness, then some business. And 26 years later, here we are. So yes, I've raised a family here in the Tampa Bay area. I keep saying here in the Tampa Bay area, and it's ironic. I am sitting in Virginia Beach right now as we talk about this. I could actually go to a Norfolk Tides game tonight. I'm not sure if they're home or not, but while I'm here, I could go.
Sowers isn't there anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And so, the Norfolk Tides might be the 17th best team in baseball, any baseball right now, as loaded as they are. But again, with Tampa, it's always been a tough market. There's many other things to do. We have the beaches, the best weather, all the other things. And so I think that more than anything has we don't have huge per capita income. So we don't have the corporate base that we have. But all that aside, I mean, the Rays management, at least the management of the last 17 years, has done a great job of running the team, obviously, on the field, the product. And I think also bringing fans in as much as they can. And now, lo and behold, they're as close as they ever have been to getting a new stadium. Will that be a panacea? I don't think so. Maybe a short-term solution like we've seen in places like Pittsburgh, Denver, and the like. But in the end, it's always going to be a challenging market.
Yeah, if I were to put you on assignment for an honorarium to write a guest piece of, you know, 60 inches of depth for a Sunday Sun banner takeout, inked by the great Pete Williams, baseball writer and great mind of 30 years, and saying a guy named Rubenstein bought the team here. Angelos is gone. They have all this young talent. You've already given the aforementioned loaded Norfolk Tides and this organization. 50,000 feet me from the outside is the guest on my show in Baltimore, and coming back as a guy that knows a lot of stuff and has seen a lot of stuff and used to write about all of this kind of stuff, including work stoppages, money, television. I mean, I remember when getting the stadium built was the most important thing because that's where the revenue, and then it was the club level, and then it was we're going to get a cable television deal, and we're going to hoodwink Yes Network and Nesson and Masson, and that's where we're going to get all the money. I'm not convinced they know where their money's coming from, and even the guy that bought in, who's the billionaire, and he's 74 years old, how long is he going to own it? Is it a cab ride? Is it a toy? But fixing the Orioles has been my charge from the beginning. Like, it's why I did Free the Birds now 18 and a half years later through all of this and the awfulness of what you remember with Cal Ripken living in D.C. and really the Orioles, you know, Camden Yards was your home park for the years you covered all those teams. So you said 98, 99, right? When you left, it all fell apart, Pete. We haven't been in a good year since 98, but Baltimore and building it back up. Nationals exist now. Nationals have won. They have a stadium. They have all the money in the weighted market in the same way that Miami would have all the money against Tampa, and they don't do baseball down there either. I mentioned lacrosse as being, and I will continue to mention that, as being a major obstacle in this marketplace for getting people interested in baseball, playing the game of baseball, knowing the rules of baseball, having young people that want to go out and be a part of it for more than hero worship. Where do you sit on the Orioles' resurrection? And I don't just mean on the field, because that's good for now, but they're going to have to pay for this at some point if they want to keep the players around here. And this is really the time for them to grow this thing and become the, dare I say, Green Bay Packers of baseball.
Right. Yeah, I'm bullish on the Orioles. And I think of what happened here in the Tampa Bay area without a tradition. But we had an owner who was every bit as hated as the Angelos family and Vince Domoli. And so when he finally gave up the reins and ultimately passed, even long before he passed, it was really a breath of fresh air. And the new regime came in and turned things around. And they've been running the Rays, having their current regime, for 15 years. They don't have a World Series title to show for it. They have two appearances, and that's good. But I guess with the Orioles, yeah, I think the as we've seen from 91 to 99-ish or so, that the Orioles could be as big and as impressive as any team in baseball financially, on the field, attendance, anything else. And I think it still can be. I think you're absolutely right. And they do have, oddly enough, even with the Nationals, a regional appeal that they established all those years when there were no Nationals there. And so I think that's good. I think Camden Yards remains Camden Yards. Yes, it needs a facelift, as all 30-some-odd year-old stadiums do, but it is still the standard bearer, with all respect to San Diego, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, and everything else that's been built. Nobody has replicated the magic you have there with the warehouse and that footprint on the Inner Harbor. So I think all of that are reasons why I am bullish, along with this nucleus, along with, heck, Cal Ripken being involved at whatever level, who knows, but that helps too. So yeah, I think there's so many reasons for optimism in Baltimore right now.
Chasing the Yankees again, man, they never go away. And that would speak to the money. That would speak to the here and now part of this. And even you being down in Tampa, that they have found a way to compete in that way. But I don't know that fans are going to want to hear that if they come out and support this program and Gunnar Henderson or Adley Rutschman wind up in the Yankees or wind up with the Red Sox in some sort of twisted way, that even 5 years from now, there'll be such an imbalance because of media, because of the size of the market, all the things you talk about, not having the money to buy club levels and put stadium naming rights and all the things that Angelos could have taken advantage of and never did, but Rubenstein's going to have to if they're really going to compete here long-term. I mean, I'll hear that Tampa model all day long. One place it hasn't worked is at the turnstile.
Yeah, and I think first off, before we get to that issue, when we talk about the Yankees, I always find it interesting that they have not won a World Series since George Steinbrenner passed. And the boss is buried not far from where I live. The boss made his home in the Tampa area for many years, and it was always interesting how he was just a beloved figure here in the Tampa area, just a community citizen and everything. And I bring that up because I just have never thought the Yankees have the edge or the something since the boss has passed. And so they can keep spending money, and they always do, but they just don't seem to have the kick in the butt that they got under George for so many years. And yes, with respect to the turnstile, it's a tough sell, whether you're talking lacrosse, whether you're talking whatever. And I mean, I see this here in the Tampa Bay area, where lacrosse is not big. Kids still play baseball to a big degree. However, that doesn't always translate into support for the major league team, or it does for spring. I mean, spring training is a tourist thing. That's always going to sell out and whatever. But the Rays, they have to rely on the locals, and it is a tough sell, no question about it.
Love the Orioles. I'm seeing this sort of resurrection with this kind of program. More than that, it's even, and I say to my wife, like, my favorite players are like Ryan O'Hearn, who fail elsewhere. And they've managed to put a system here together to maximize the Rutschmans and the Kerstads and the Cowsers, the lottery picks for the years where they lost 115 games, that they get something out of that on the backside. But Henderson was a sandwich pick. Westberg's another guy that they've managed to get to the big leagues. They've really built something formidable here in taking advantage of the analytics and having players with a growth mindset here, that there's an Astro Ball 2 thing happening here from a journalism standpoint. For the stuff you like to write about and that sort of forward-thinking thing from a fan's perspective, there's something really unique going on here with this Orioles program that writers are going to want to write about.
Oh, no question. Look, it's become unusual to build a baseball team through the draft. It doesn't really happen anymore. Look, for all the accolades the Rays get, rightly so, they haven't nailed a draft pick since Evan Longoria and David Price. And we're going back 15, 16 years ago. Now, they have absolutely nailed every trade, every scrap heap acquisition, whatever. They are the kings of that. But when you look at what the Orioles have done, yeah, that's awesome. What they have nailed their draft picks. They've nailed draft picks later in the draft. They've and added to the scrap heap with them. There's no huge free agents here. I mean, Craig Kimbrell's not going to qualify as a huge free agent. It's a one-year deal. So you look at what the Orioles have done, and it's really a dare I say, traditional old school way of assembling a roster. And if you can keep that churn going with, trading stars ahead of time to replenish your farm system, then you could have some legs to this. It could go on for 8 to 10 years, but yeah, they are going to have to pony up eventually for free agents, whether it's their own or someone else's.
All right, Pete Williams is our guest. He was the longtime columnist at Baseball Weekly, USA Baseball Weekly and USA Today. Wrote thousands of pieces on baseball, is a true baseball historian and a fitness guru and an author and my friend in the real world and all that good stuff. You and I haven't gotten together, I don't think, since like maybe Springsteen about a year and a half ago. We were like really sat and had a couple of drinks. We were talking. And at that point, the Orioles hadn't become the Orioles yet. Rutschman was up. And so we probably didn't spend 2 minutes talking about baseball. We were probably talking real life and your wife and my wife and battles and all of this stuff and real life stuff with kids and concerts and whatnot. But you are a collectible guru. And I know we've talked about this because when your book came out, you came on the show for an hour or whatever, and you were a little shocked that I collected a lot of baseball cards as a kid. I was the kid in the neighborhood who had a giant. I have a picture of my father. I featured it in the 25th anniversary video of the baseball card cabinet I had. I had a giant, like, it was meant for punch cards for a computer. It was a giant file cabinet, weighed 1,000 pounds, and had all my baseball cards year by year in it. All the kids came to my house to buy cards. If I would have known those George Brett rookies were going to be selling for $3,000 a piece, dude. So the baseball resurrection, my last name's Aparicio, that remains. So I have that as always a part of me. Pete, I collected every Aparicio card in the early 80s when I was a kid. Before I was 17 years old, I had every Aparicio you could think of, other than a couple of weird leaf, weird things you couldn't find at shows and stuff like that. Lenny went in the Hall of Fame in 84. And I had his last jersey that Ted Patterson had from the Red Sox in 73. So I had some collectibles, and some of it I got rid of and auctioned off. Just wanted to get rid of it. I didn't want to have a moth eat Louis Aparicio's jersey that was autographed in my closet. But Louis signed everything on a trip here on the 20th anniversary of the 66 team. So 1986, some of it's dated 80s, it was June of 86. So he signed every card in my collection, and I had it all in a manila envelope, and I hadn't seen it in, I'll be married 20 years last year. I hadn't seen it in 18 or 19 years. And a lot of things disappeared around my radio station. I had some guys with loose fingers through the years. Things disappeared. I just assumed, because I hadn't seen it, that it was stolen, lost, gone to the wolves. I mean, Aparicio rookie card autographed, 57 autographed, you know, high number 61, hard to get 71, mint black corners, all that, right? I found it. I found the envelope when I moved 2 years ago-ish. 2 years ago, March-ish. I found it all. All of it pristine, the Heartland statue, everything. I found it all. So it got me going, and then the baseball team got going, and this is what happens with old fuddy-duddy farts like you and me. I found eBay, and I found these Pacifica belt buckles, the Rockstar belt buckles, and I'm like, I wonder what the old Houston Oilers stuff that I love to collect look like. And then I went into the Aparicio card collection, and I buffed up my 71 Kelloggs, and I found the 70 Kelloggs in still the wrapper, you know, where you could see through it. And then I started finding a 58 All-Star cellophane Christmas pack. And then, dude, then the jersey started to happen. So I need to show you. So the Orioles started winning last year, and this jersey was available on the internet. Now you can see this is a 76-78 Flanagan Tippy Stanhouse 79 Oriole jersey, but it was an Aparicio jersey that was a medium, that's old school, that's made, not made in China last week for me. This is a 20, it's polyester, dude. It sweats like a pig. And I bought it for $80 on the internet, and it was the proudest possession of my life. So this is where collections, and I want to get you into collecting, because then I had to have the 70 Aparicio with the 100th anniversary throwback that's on the night. It's a 69 jersey, and I had to get it. So I got the fever, Pete. I got the fever of collecting. What is it that makes people like you and me want this stuff?
Yeah, and I have been moving lately. So I've had not something that dramatic, but I am stumbling across stuff that I had forgotten about or thought was long gone. Or
I wonder how much I could get on eBay for that.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, there is, I think you certainly, you reach a point of middle age where I think these things starting to become more meaningful to you. And I think if you look at the heyday of collecting, when things blew up in for the first time in the early 1980s, it was surrounding 1952 Mickey Mantle rookie cards. And the reason they blew up at that time is because guys in 1982 who were paying all this money for Mantle rookie cards were kids in 1952. And so now you and I are kind of looking at that same 30-ish years gap, right, if you will. And then we're suddenly feeling nostalgic again for these kind of things. For you, it's something with a deep familial connection. For the rest of us, something maybe that we only have the connection of watching it as a kid. So I think there is this kind of second wave.
I feel that way about my Tony Gwynn jersey. Yeah, and a George Brett powder blue five royal, like a 1980. I'd be all about there is something about that, and the kids today don't have that. I mean, the Orioles are wearing pink today, blue tomorrow, marine this. Like, we're gonna have a black hat. We're gonna have an orange hat. We're gonna have see through. We're gonna they associate differently to sports than you and I did.
I think when teams are wearing 8, 10, 20 different uniforms a year. And you can turn on an NBA game these days and not even know who's playing. I mean, the Milwaukee Bucks are wearing blue. Which team is the home team? Cause you never know anymore that the home team doesn't wear white anymore in the NBA or Major League Baseball for that.
Or hockey, by the way.
Or hockey. Yeah. At least the NFL is being, generally consistent, I think.
Except when they put on those color rush and everybody looks like they're mustard versus ketchup.
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah. And so I don't get it. The one thing, I mean, look, Jerry Seinfeld had his famous riff where he goes, players change teams so often that really you're just rooting for clothes, my clothes to beat your clothes. Right. Well, now we don't even have consistent clothes. I mean, so, and Jerry said that like in the early 90s too. So, so this is not a new argument, but now we've at least gotten rid of, for the most part. I mean, the one great thing we can say about the Yankees is that they don't subscribe to any of this silliness. They're not putting the names on the backs of uniforms. They're wearing home and away, and that's it. The Dodgers are generally, you know, pretty consistent that way too, and sometimes the Red Sox. But every other team, you can't tell. I mean, here in the Tampa Bay area, I mean, the Rays have so many uniforms, I don't even know what's what on any given day. And so, but you lose that connection that you and I had with the powder blue, with whatever uniform that resonated with us. I mean, I was a Dale Murphy fan, and the Braves had some cheesy powder blue uniforms of the early 80s, but we associate them with winning because the Braves didn't win that much back then. They went back to their traditional
America's team.
America's team, of course. And so, but yeah, the uniforms matter. And I think baseball is just so, like the other leagues, so intent on the short-term revenue bump of all these different uniforms that they missed the big picture as usual.
You give me that 74 Hank Aaron, that white with the right. I mean, come on, with that panel, that Ralph Garr, give it to me, right?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. The Braves had some gorgeous uniforms through the years, and their traditional one that they've gone back to starting in the late 80s that we now associate the 90s winning with, that's been a good run as well.
What's your collectible of choice? I mean, you wrote about all of them. Like, for me, it's really weird. Like, I got the Aparicio Milk Duds card, and I thought, that's kind of cool and fun. He was on a 7-Eleven cup at some point. I cannot find it anywhere. So there's some weird sort of off-the-beaten-path weird collections. I like my belt buckles because I can wear them. I physically wore my police belt buckle to a Sting show at the Symphony Orchestra. I literally wore my Cheap Trick, and my wife wore her Heart belt buckle. I wore my Rolling Stones belt buckle the other day. I wore my Who belt buckle to a Pearl Jam show so they would play Baba O'Reilly for me. So I, like, there's something about wearing it or wearing a hat or wearing a jersey that is way different. Then, and my buddy Mark Miller and I get into this because he collects Brooks Robinson cards, and we talk about collecting and whatnot, that, like, I don't want a card that's rated in a case that feels like I can't touch it. And the beauty of the card, I'll never see it because it has the PSA thing and so I go into card shops when I'm on the road sometimes, and I see things, but I value the stuff that's worth $3 that's like in a corner much more so than having a sharp cornered Bobby Clemente from 58 or whatever, right? Like, the card collecting part of it, I love the art part of it, but I don't know what to do with it. Baseballs and programs and autographed things for walls. I prefer something a little more functional as I get older than here, look at my card. But there is a weird part of collect, like chairs. From the polo grounds, you want to sit in my chair, or do I want to hang it on the wall? But we all have a different feel for that collecting thing. Like, I collected that autograph. I was there when Willie Mays signed that. Or I went to a convention hall in Atlantic City and paid Pete Rose $300 to sign my gambling slip. You know, like, there's some really esoteric, weird stuff out there. But for me, as I get older, the things that come from the heart, like wearing a Tony Gwynn jersey or wearing a Dan Pastorini jersey, I'm looking for a Earl Campbell right now that fits me. They're all like so big. So I've gotten back into that part. That's the little part of sports that I'm not going to let these pricks take away from me. And I mean that sincerely, because they've tried to take my love of sports away. You know that.
Sure. There are two things out of that, Nestor. I think the first off, yes, I have my Dale Murphy game used jersey. And so I do wear that to games occasionally. And I'm always intrigued by the guys who come up to me and who know it's a gamer, because you have to know the patch or the tags, right? And so there are a few that will always.
If you're getting smaller, it's big on you then, huh?
Oh, yeah, it is huge.
Hangs off you. Yeah. Okay.
Murph 6'4", 200 in his prime. You know, I'm not, you know, I'm 5'10". So, yeah, it does hang off me. And then secondly, one thing I've been meaning to bring up, because I think you were entirely ahead of your time, okay? Whenever a sports, not all the time, but often when a sports celebrity passes, you will post online a photo of yourself with that person, because you had the foresight in the 80s and 90s to have photographs of yourself taken interviewing people, or maybe they were on your show. We think nothing of this today, but back in the 80s or 90s, you had to actually have an actual camera, right? And so, and you had the pictures.
Like, I have a picture of me and Cal Ripken. I think it might be the only picture I had of Cal Ripken then, other than running into him somewhere and taking a picture somewhere. But like, right. We didn't have a lot of cameras running around, and a lot of my pictures were taken by photographers that were on the field, and they gave them to me afterward.
Yes,
for sure. Yeah.
But I wish I would have had my photographer friends, and we have a lot of the same photographer friends. And
you have all the press passes, but you don't have pictures, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Like, you know, I wish I had interviews, pictures of me in the dugout or in around the batting cage or wherever. You know, I went to various people's homes and interviewed them for various things. I wish I had to me, it would be the memorabilia of my career. I wish I had. It would be valuable to nobody but me. But right. I wish I had more. You know, I once interviewed Mickey Mantle at his restaurant on the occasion of his 60th birthday. Okay. And nobody thought at that time in 1991, I would not have thought to bring a camera. Right. And so he actually did sign a photo for me.
I had lunch with Robert Plant and my kid and didn't have a camera. Exactly. I mean, like, there's no picture of it at all. But I sat with Robert Plant for an hour and a half, and I just didn't. It was 1989. I didn't have a camera.
Nobody would have thought to do that. That's the thing. And so, you know, I have a signed baseball from when I was 7 years old at a Richmond Braves game that my dad took me to with Dale Murphy. You know, what if dad had brought a camera? How priceless would that photo be?
I don't have one picture of my pop and I at Memorial Stadium together. Not one. Not
yeah.
one.
We forget just what a strange era it is where we shoot 100 pictures of everything a day. You know, where it wasn't that long ago where we might take 100 photos a year. And so we just don't have those kind of personal.
Well, this morning I posted Bill Walton. We lost Bill Walton in the overnight. And I had Bill Walton on my show one time in my life. He was walking Radio Row in San Diego. And Dan Shaughnessy was sitting on my show. And Dan knew him from Boston, right? So he's like, yeah, sure. So he sat down, and 25 minutes later, we're talking about San Diego and his height and how he shops and the Grateful Dead and like doing all this stuff. There's one picture, and it's a really awkward picture because Bill's got his arm up. I'm sort of off of Bill. My pass is hanging down. And there's some rando dude sitting between us reading it head down. You only see the top of his head. He's reading a newspaper, and there's no posing. There's no nothing. And I'm like, Yeah, it was one picture because I had to take that to the photomat, and the film costs $8 a roll, and there was only 24 pictures on it, and then to get it developed, it was another $8, and all of a sudden, like, I didn't shoot a whole roll with me and Bill Walton. There's one picture. It's good. It's not great. It's not posed, but there's one picture. And somebody's like, "Who's the rando dude?" And I'm like, "I don't know, but that's what makes it great." Because it wasn't a television show. It wasn't even a set. It was like a convention hall with curtains, like literally. And there's nothing sexy about any of the pictures other than the fact that Bill's dead and it's 26 years ago, and I'm blessed to have had something that looks like a picture there because I had a camera on the desk and probably said to somebody, "Can you take a picture when Bill?" It's Bill Walton. And they took a picture, and it turned out to be on the day he died, something that I've gotten a lot of feedback on, but it's so weird because it's not upscale. It's not
No.
internet worthy.
No, but think back if in the 80s or 90s, if people weren't as obsessed with getting autographs and they were more obsessed with getting photos, I think the athletes would have been fine with that because they know people aren't looking to make any money off a photo of themselves with them, right? And so they would have probably been far more amenable to getting photos back then. Of course, today it's out of control and no
And
one wants
nobody's got a picture in the field with Eddie Murray. Nobody, right?
to.
And
Exactly.
all those nights that Cal Ripken, during the streak, signed every popcorn box. You remember all that?
Sure.
I don't know that many people post pictures of Cal. They didn't take the
No.
camera to the ballpark that night.
No one was taking photos in 1996. We were still not to cell phones yet at that point, let
Well,
alone
Pete, I tell you what, man. I hope to have a picture of you and I at a World
smartphones.
Series game together one day, and me wearing my Aparicio throwback, and all that good stuff. And I miss being around baseball people, and I think that part of being a media member and having that privilege taken away. I'm under double secret probation review now. It's been told to me by Mr. Rubenstein's people, so I'm just assuming that part of my deal's over, and it allows me to write more capably from the outside. But I'm the relationships inside of baseball, and I know it's changed. I know from people inside, from people around the game, that if I were back, I would be treated like trash no matter what, because it says press on the top of it. And those kinds of relationships that we had that I talk about 30 years later with Tony Gwynn and different people, and even Tom Glavine, and you talk about the Braves. I covered the Braves, Leo Mazzoni, all those. I was around all of those teams, and there was a different openness to the media and people like you and I, because we would come into that clubhouse in foreign territory and we'd really have to know a lot about baseball in order to get over. The minute we would go up to a player and not know enough is the minute we weren't going to be there long. You had to really earn your way for Tony Gwynn to show you his video setup.
Yeah, you did, and it was a different era. Unfortunately, players, feel they can interact more directly through social media, and maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But yeah, from what I hear, you just don't have the access in any sport that you used to. Boy, let's not get started on college sports where there's no access. But I mean, and then at
And
least.
plenty of money.
And plenty of money. Yeah, they're pros now. You'd think they'd be more accessible. But in the professional ranks, the access. I used to say. I mean, nobody was more accessible to the public and the media, I should say, than the 1990s baseball player. Nobody, not the president of the United States. I mean, think about it. We used to get in there 3.5 hours before the game every day, and we could be there after the game every
Dude,
day.
covering the Orioles, I knew players everywhere in the league because I made a point to introduce myself to Kirby Puckett and Jose Canseco and George Brett. And I keep relationships with Jeff Montgomery and Brian McCray. I mean, these players that never played here, they played elsewhere. And I got to know them because they were amenable in a city to meet a long-haired, youngish reporter who loved baseball as much as they did and ask questions about, what do you do with that bone on the bat? What is how do you warm up? Tony, tell me about video. And it's amazing how much of the science that we saw. And there's a fellow named John Miller, not that John Miller, different, doing a book on Earl Weaver. And he's talking about analytics and the modern mind of baseball coming from video and analytics and putting statistics and video together and probability together. And voila, you get Sig Meidel and Mike Elias, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And so when you look at that period, and again, another reason I've loved Tropicana Field is that when teams came into the Trop, now we're going early 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, there weren't, I was really the only national writer based there. So I had the whole room to myself, and the Rays were so terrible back then, and players were in a good mood because they're in Tampa. You know, they might have had some fun the night before when they got into Tampa. And so they're staying at a lovely hotel in St. Pete. They're coming in. They know they're going to win three or four from the Rays. So, you know, guys were always in a good mood when they came into that visiting Rays clubhouse. And so, yeah, but it's a different time now. And and I think now more than ever, it's just more challenging. And I'm glad I don't have to do it on a day-to-day basis.
Where have you gone, Rick Vaughn? That's what I'm going to say right there. Boma heater, Ricky. Pete Williams is our guest. He is a former and reformed USA Today baseball writer and USA Baseball Weekly. Reformed enough to continue a friendship with me 30 years later. He is down in the Tampa area. What are you doing? You don't do any more collectible. I break all this collectible stuff out for naught. You're not doing that. You're not covering baseball, though you seem pretty involved with this Tampa team that's coming to Baltimore this weekend. We're going to be that Fately's giving out these Maryland lottery tickets. Are you doing fitness ball? What are you doing? Because, I mean, I know you in the real world. You're like a real fitness guru, and you've taken that on, and, you know, reformed baseball writer. You're probably better off writing about health, Pete.
Yeah, I like to think so. So yeah, a segue, about 20 years ago, I made, was more into the fitness space. I'd been writing about it as far back as the late 90s with Baseball Weekly. But then I met a prominent trainer by the name of Mark Verstegen. He started a company called Exos. He was best known early on for training Nomar Garciaparra and training guys for the NFL Combine, which he still does. But he's built that into a 5,000 employee worldwide empire that trains a lot of Fortune 100 wellness facilities and that sort of thing. And so Mark and I wrote 6 books together, most notably Core Performance, which was a fitness bestseller. So that did really well. And that led to some other fitness works for me as well with other authors and co-authors. And I picked up some training credentials myself. And then I got involved in triathlon and endurance sports, and I've written extensively for Men's Health, Men's Journal, Men's Fitness, Muscle and Fitness, all of those fitness publications as well. So still a pivot, if you will. It's still in the same space, but a little bit of a different tech.
But also, you don't have curmudgeonly billionaire baseball people. When you go to somebody and say, teach me how to live better, teach me how to be healthier, and I know you to be a student of life in general, what would you say to our audience if you want to give them a little pick-me-up for the summertime? What's your best advice? I always tell people my best advice is oatmeal and fresh fruit in the morning. Get your day off to a good start, a good solid foundation. When I lost weight back in 06, I've kept my weight off 18 years. I lost 30 pounds in the summer of 06, kept it off. And it's the power of movement. You know, like I walked 40,000 steps through New York City this weekend, but I'm not a runner. I've had knee surgery. My knee hurts a little bit today from walking so much. As we get older, as you've gotten older, what's your advice?
I think the movement, whatever that may be, I have been moving lately, actually. After 25 years, my wife and I downsized. And so the moving of stuff, the moving of possessions, the moving of the cleaning, and there is no better workout than yard work or housework. I mean, you move your body in all three planes of motion. You're squatting, you're lifting, you're whatever. So on days that you're working in the yard or in the house, don't worry about hitting the gym. You will be more than adequately trained for those days. And so I've been on a run this, not literally a run, but a run of housework and yard work lately, it seems, in recent weeks. And so, yeah, just keep moving, whatever it is. I'm no longer the triathlete and distance runner I once was, but I can still swim. I can still do paddling. I can still go for walks. I can still do yoga. You know, whatever that is, don't let yourself get bored. Don't let yourself get into routines.
Yeah, my friends at Planet Fitness, you know, whenever we bring them on, we talk about movement and just getting out. And the thing that they talk so much about there is just doing real life stuff, just being in the kind of shape where you can walk around New York and get on and off a subway and get up and down steps at a Rolling Stones show when you're 55 and seeing other people there that couldn't, believe me, at a Rolling Stones show. And knowing that, you know, I'll be 65, 75, 85 soon. And I seeing Mick at 80, dude, it's like, you know, all things are possible. And you live in a part of the world where people are a little more fit because you can be outside 12 months a year. That yoga part that you talked about with me, that's been a real lifesaver for me. And I think when I was with you a year and a half ago, my back was a little screwy at the time, even sitting at the bar versus standing at the bar. Just finding things that are falling apart, finding strengthening activities that don't quit on it. Make sure you're staying stronger every day.
Yeah. And so there's always a tendency as we get older, or, you know, 10 years ago, I was in a car accident and I was convinced because doctors told me, well, this is your new normal. I'm like, no, I don't accept that. I was 44 at the time. That can't be. I wasn't paralyzed. And even then, that's not accepted by a lot of people who've been down that road. And so I said, no, I'm going to pursue every means of movement possible to remedy this situation. And people in far, far worse accidents than what I had made it back and beyond to those sorts of things. So don't accept whatever lot of life you're in, whether it's from age or accident or anything else. I think you can find a way through movement to cure what ails you.
All right, Pete, I knew you would educate us here. Pete's like, what are we going to talk about? I'm like, baseball, I think. Maybe in the neighborhood. Well, the Orioles are good, right? I mean, I've known you a long time. You and I don't talk enough baseball in Baltimore, right? Like, we've waited a long, long time to see what this can be again. And it's been fun to talk about it and fun to dream it a little bit. And knowing guys like you back when it was full here and it was vibrant again. And here comes Tampa this weekend in a meaningful series in Baltimore. We haven't had enough of that.
No, it's great to see. For so long, Baltimore and Tampa Bay were bringing in the rear of the American League East, right? You could count on some combination of New York, Boston, and then Toronto in the middle, and then Baltimore and Tampa Bay battling it out for fourth. So it's really nice to see that turned on end as it was last year.
Baseball, it always sucks us back in, especially us old guys here. Pete Williams can be found out on the interweb anywhere that great books are written. He is an author and a fitness author and guru, but I'll always think of him as a baseball collectible and my old baseball friend from back in the, and you know, John Eisenberg called it the glory era of sports writing. The golden era of sports writing is what he called it. So you're going to say the 90s baseball. I'll always have Chuck Knobloch is what I'm thinking. I am now. We are WNST AM 1570 Towson Baltimore. Come find us on the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery. Get some Pac-Man scratch-offs. We're going to be everywhere all month long. Check it all out at BaltimorePositive.com.